Faith in the fiery furnace. I didn't make that graphic, but man, it looks fancy. Faith in the fiery furnace, Daniel chapter 3 is where we are this evening. If there's one lesson to be learned from Daniel, it is this. God is sovereign over the rulers of the earth. There is a tension that exists between the idea that God is in control and the idea of human free will. Because, and we're going to see this tonight, the rulers of the earth are not righteous people, by and large. My guess is a minuscule percentage, less than 1% of the rulers of the earth throughout history have been people we would consider to be righteous. I would wager more than half have just been plain wicked. Just not even reasonable people, but just despots and tyrants and so on and so forth. And yet, we know that God is sovereign over these rulers, and God does allow them to exist. And Nebuchadnezzar is a classic example. He's the king of Babylon for the first four chapters of Daniel. He is a classic example of a ruler. He does try to do a reasonable job, and yet he is, as a selfish human, he is overwhelmed by pride. And we're going to see that in the story in Daniel chapter 3, that rulers, and it's a well-known expression, absolute power corrupts absolutely. When you're in charge of stuff, it just goes to your head. And one of the reasons I think that God has set up the church the way that he has, one of the reasons it's not good to have a single elder, why the idea of plurality of elders, is because when you're in charge of stuff all by yourself, it just gets to you. It does. Daniel is a classic example, the book of Daniel, that is a classic example of a king who was sort of reasonable some of the time, but the other part of the time was just a selfish ruler. And yet God allowed him to be in power. And we're going to see some of that as we go through this lesson. Daniel 3 and 4 form sort of a two-act play on humility. The importance of humility, the importance of humbling yourself before God. Daniel chapter 3, of course, we're going to look at tonight. Next 2 weeks from now, we'll look at Daniel chapter 4. And in Daniel chapter 3, we see the pride of the king and the humility of God's servants. And then in Daniel chapter 4, we see the downfall of the king because of his pride. And it is really a two-act play about humility and pride and how we deal in our relationship with God. Now, I want to begin with James 4, 6 through 10. He gives more grace. Therefore, it says, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. This is played out exactly in Nebuchadnezzar's life, in the life of King Nebuchadnezzar. Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil. He will flee from you. Draw near to God. He will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners. Purify your hearts, you double-minded. Be wretched and mourn and weep. A lot of that has to do with humility, the attitude of humility. Let your laughter be turned to mourning, your joy to gloom. Humble yourselves before the Lord, and he will exalt you. It is interesting that God exalts Nebuchadnezzar anyway. Even when Nebuchadnezzar is not humbling himself before the Lord, he is exalted. That's not what we're talking about. This is talking about in James, on a personal level, your relationship with God. He will exalt you in the kingdom, perhaps, or exalt you in his relationship with you. This is not talking about the way that God deals with the rulers of the earth, because Nebuchadnezzar was exalted anyway, although the opposite was also true, that his pride brought him low. And we'll see that in chapter 4, as his pride brings him low. Daniel 3 tells the story of the one who chooses to humble himself before God, those three guys that we're going to look at, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who, in contrast with the overwhelming pride of the king, were willing to be humble about stuff and humble themselves before the Lord. Daniel 3, verse 1, King Nebuchadnezzar made an image of gold whose height was 60 cubits, breadth was 6 cubits. It's a tall thing. He set it up on the plain of Dura in the province of Babylon. Why would he do this? Okay, well, previously, Daniel chapter 2, that Daniel told the king this. Daniel, the emissary of God, this was the dream. Now we will tell the king its interpretation. You, O king, the king of kings, to whom the God of heaven has given the kingdom, the power, the might, the glory, into all whose hand he has given wherever they dwell, the children of men, the beasts of the field, the birds of the heavens, making you rule over them all, you are the head of gold. Well, Daniel just got done telling the king how awesome he is, right? He's informed the king of his own greatness. Of course, we know where the greatness came from. And Daniel says it too, right? Even though King Nebuchadnezzar is great, what does Daniel say? That God has given this to you. God has given you this power, given you this glory. But it's like all the king hears is that I'm awesome. I am amazing. Look at all this stuff I rule over. And so it's not really surprising that he builds this giant statue to himself because God's prophet just got done telling me how awesome I am. Daniel 3, 4 through 6, and so this is what is proclaimed. The herald proclaimed aloud, "When you are commanded, O peoples, nations, languages," basically all the people in the kingdom of Babylon, "that when you hear the sound of the horn, the pipe, the lyre, the trigon, the harp, the bagpipe," a lot of different kinds of music. I don't know what that would have sounded like. "You are to fall down and worship the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up, and whoever does not fall down and worship shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace." This is the story of a man who has immense pride. Pride enough to build himself a giant statue and say, "Bow down and worship." And even though God elevated him, the king, and he was told that God has elevated him, Nebuchadnezzar does not care about God at all. Do not misunderstand. There are several places we're going to look at in the story of Daniel where Nebuchadnezzar sort of acknowledges or worships or praises Jehovah. But make no mistake, Nebuchadnezzar does not care for Jehovah insofar, except perhaps as far as Jehovah has blessed him. Other than that, he doesn't care one lick about what Jehovah deserves or wants or whether he should be changing his behavior. Daniel 3:7, "As soon as all the people heard the sound of those instruments," I'm not going to read them out, "every kind of music, they all fell down and worshiped the golden image that King Nebuchadnezzar had set up." Except, of course, we know the exception, right? "Therefore, at a certain time, the Chaldeans came forward and maliciously accused the Jews, and they declared to King Nebuchadnezzar, 'O king, live forever. You, O king, have made a decree that this thing shall happen, that you shall bow down and worship. And whoever does not fall down and worship shall be cast into a burning fiery furnace. There are certain Jews whom you have appointed over the affairs of the province of Babylon, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. To these men, O king, pay no attention to you. They do not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." Now, it should not have been surprising to Nebuchadnezzar that they did not serve his gods. That should not have been surprising. Who were these men? Now, in Daniel, we've already seen these men three or four times already. Daniel 1:3 through 6. Let's see here. We're not going to read all this. This is basically the king commands them to bring the Jews to Babylon. We've seen this before. Oh, I will read this. "Men without blemish, of good appearance, skillful in all wisdom, endowed with knowledge, understanding, learning, and competent." Okay, and so he brings them from Jerusalem to Babylon. But at the end of these, among these were Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah of the tribe of Judah. Now I've got Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah bolded because that's these three guys. So they're brought over with Daniel. The chief of the eunuchs gave them names. Daniel he called Belteshazzar. Hananiah he called Shadrach. Mishael he called Meshach. And Azariah he called Abednego. Just giving them new names. I'm not sure what that's about. Daniel 2:15 through 18, he declared to okay. So if you remember in Daniel chapter 2, then there's this vision that the king has, and he's like, "Interpret the dream for me." No, not even interpret the dream. "Tell me the dream that I had and then interpret it for me." Of course, none of the wise men can, and so they go to Daniel. He declared to Arioch, the king's captain, "Why is the decree of the king so urgent?" Arioch made the matter known to Daniel. Daniel went in and requested the king to appoint him a time that he might show the interpretation to the king. Then Daniel went to his house and made the matter known to Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah, his companions, told them to seek mercy from God of heaven concerning this mystery so that Daniel and his companions might not be destroyed with the rest of the wise men of Babylon. Verse 48, after Daniel's interpreted the dream, then the king gave Daniel high honors and many great gifts and made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief priest over all the wise men. Daniel made a request of the king and he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. The text flips back and forth without rhyme or reason. Just flips back and forth between the two names over the affairs of the province of Babylon, but Daniel remained at the king's court. So the pecking order, after all this shakes out in Daniel chapter 2, the king, and then Daniel, and then Daniel's friends. They're right under Daniel. They're over everybody else. So as we look through the first two chapters of the Daniel, and I didn't talk about this when we were talking about these two chapters, they're there with Daniel every step of the way, right? Everything that Daniel does, they do. Everything that they're involved with, Daniel's involved with. So they're good-looking. They're smart/wise. They are competent, which is interesting that the text brings out that they're competent. They, like Daniel, refused the king's food. We saw that in chapter 1. They, like Daniel, were put into positions of authority at the end of chapter 2. So the book focuses on Daniel because it's written from Daniel's perspective. And Daniel's going to be the one to receive the visions in the latter half of the book. But these other three guys are with him every step of the way. And everything we said about Daniel in the first two lessons in Daniel would easily apply to these three men as well. Everything we've said about the greatness of Daniel and how awesome Daniel was and how great of a servant of God Daniel was, all of that applies to Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Daniel just gets to be the center stage, A, because he's writing the book, and B, because he's going to receive the visions at the end. But everything you think about when you think of Daniel, you can also apply those same things to these three guys. So what happens? Daniel 3, 13 through 15. Nebuchadnezzar, in a furious rage, commanded that Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego be brought. So they brought these men before the king, and he answered them and said, "Is it true, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, that you do not serve my gods or worship the golden image that I have set up?" Why would this be surprising? As I'm reading the text, this should not be surprising to the king. He knows the God that Daniel worships. He's acknowledged the God that Daniel worships. But now all of a sudden, he wants them to bow down to him. "Now, if you are ready when you hear the sound, fall down and worship the image that I have made, well and good. But if you do not worship, you shall immediately be cast into a burning fiery furnace. And who is the God that will deliver you out of my hands?" Again, he should know the answer to that question already. What does this say about the personality of the king? "Are you so insecure, king, that you can't handle three dudes not worshiping you? Are you so prideful and so arrogant that you can't handle three young men not bowing down before you?" Not only is he prideful, but he's really, it seems to be, insecure, that he's not willing to stand for any deviation from what he wants. Daniel 3, 16 through 18, when we get into the meat of the lessons, "Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to him," and this is so interesting to me, "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you in this matter." What? You're here before the king. He's about to throw you in a fire. He wants you to do this thing. We don't even need to talk to you about this. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us from the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand. But if not, be it known to you, O king, that we will not serve your gods or worship the golden image that you have set up." We are so confident in our position, I don't even feel the need to explain myself to you. God's going to save us or not. So be it. Either way. This is such a laissez-faire, and it's not. I know they're not laissez-faire. But it's so dismissive, right? It's got to be a slap in the face of the king who's so prideful and so arrogant. "Yeah, we don't really need to give you an answer about this. I know this seems important to you, O king, but we don't really care about this. Either God's going to save us or he won't." There are two New Testament stories that echo Daniel 3, almost to a T. It's amazing how much they line up. Two New Testament stories that sort of have the same flow of a person in charge questioning someone of God. The first is in Matthew 27 when Jesus stands before the governor. The governor asked him, "Are you the king of the Jews?" And Jesus said, "You have said so." But when he was accused by the chief priests and the elders, he gave no answer. And Pilate said to him, "Do you not hear how many things they are testifying against you?" But he gave him no answer, not even to a single charge. So that the governor was greatly amazed. Again, Jesus, not justifying his actions, just letting them stand for what they are. Acts 4:19 through 20, when Peter and John are before the council, and they're being questioned again, "You got to stop doing this stuff. Why are you doing this stuff?" Peter and John answered them, "Whether it is right in the sight of God to listen to you rather than to God, you must judge. For we cannot but speak of what we have seen and heard." And they don't give an answer for why they're speaking about Jesus. You decide, we're going to do this thing. It's exactly what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego say. You decide, we're going to do this thing. There's no justification, there's no argument, there's no rationale, there's no defense. They're just letting it be what it is. Very rarely did God's people feel the need to justify themselves. They just did what God wanted. And if the consequences were what they were, let it be. I don't need to justify my position. I'm just going to do what God wants. Though admittedly, the circumstances are slightly different in Jesus' case, because I think there's more going on, of course, with the story of Jesus. And yet he does not feel the need to give a defense for who he is. When he says, "Are you the King of the Jews?" Jesus doesn't even say, "Yeah, that's true." He says, "You have said so." There's a certain amount of sense in this, because in each case, the justification for their actions, so Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego justifying their actions before the king, Jesus justifying his presence before the governor, Peter and John justifying their actions before the council, whatever justifications they would have given, the reasons why they're doing what they're doing, that's not going to matter to Nebuchadnezzar, to the king, and to the council. They don't believe, let's take for example Peter and John. Well, the Sanhedrin doesn't believe that Jesus was who he says he was. So when Peter and John answer, "We're talking like this and we're saying these things because Jesus rose from the dead and is the Lord of all creation." Well, is that going to matter to the Sanhedrin? No, they don't believe who Jesus is. And when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, "Well, the reason we're not worshiping you is because God wants us to only worship him, and God wants us to only bow down to him. And to bow down to anyone else is really blasphemy or doing what God doesn't want." Well, Nebuchadnezzar's not going to care about that. He doesn't care about Jehovah. He's not going to care what they say, what justification they give. So it does make sense that they're not going to say why they're doing what they're doing, because any reason they give is not going to matter to the people that are accusing them. So the answer, oh no, we keep going. 16 through 18 in Daniel 3. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego answered and said to the king, let's see here. Yeah, I'll just keep reading it. "O Nebuchadnezzar, we have no need to answer you. If this be so, our God whom we serve is able to deliver us out of the burning fiery furnace, and he will deliver us out of your hand, O king." And that's ended up what's happening, but they don't know that yet. And here's what I've got bolded and underlined. "But if not." If not what? If God will not save us, we still will not serve. The attitude being demonstrated here is, let the chips fall where they may. We've made our decision. We feel good about our decision. And yeah, maybe God's going to let us die. Doesn't change our decision. It doesn't change what we need to do. Matthew 26, 39 is the same attitude that Jesus demonstrates in the thing he's about to go do. Going a little farther, he fell on his face and prayed, saying, "My Father, if it be possible, let this cup pass from me. Nevertheless, not as I will, but as you will." I don't want to do this thing. I don't want this thing to happen to me, but I've made my decision, and whatever you decide, God, that's what we're going with. He's going to make his case and plead to the Father, "I would rather this not happen, but I'm going to do what you want, and however you decide this needs to go, that's what I'm going to do." Okay, Peter and John say the same thing, don't they? After they get back from being questioned by the Sanhedrin, they go and gather all the disciples together and they have this prayer with the believers. And what they pray for is not victory over the Sanhedrin, not alleviation of their problems, but what do they pray for? "And now, Lord, look upon their threats and grant to your servants to continue to speak your word with all boldness, while you stretch out your hand to heal and signs and wonders are performed through the name of your holy servant, Jesus." Not look on their threats and get rid of them. Not look on their threats and let them not come to pass. Look on their threats and just give us boldness. Let us speak, and whatever happens, happens, but let us speak boldly. As we think about our trials in our lives and the things we go through and the difficulties that we face, especially when we're being faced with difficulties because of our faith, and the things that we're doing is causing problems with, maybe it's our coworkers or our boss or our friends. As things are difficult because of the way that we are as Christians, did they seem to care what befell them very much? No. Now, I'm sure they did. But it was much more important that they did the right thing than that life was easy. It was much more important that they were good examples to those around them than that God work out their circumstances so that life was more pleasurable. Rather than praying for victory, we need to be praying for boldness and steadfastness, not victory and ease. Praying for the willingness to do what is necessary, rather than praying that God will remove the difficulty. over and over in Scripture, that seems to be the example of God's people. So, the follow-up then, what happens? Daniel 3, 24 through 25, King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished, rose up in a haste, he declared to his council, somehow I have missed a section of the text. We know what happens, right? Nebuchadnezzar gets angry, he throws them in the furnace, and when they get close to the furnace, this is not, I don't have this up there apparently, but he commands them to bring them into the furnace because he's upset with them and angry at them. And of course, what happens to the men that are dragging them to the furnace as they're dragging them to the furnace to throw them into the furnace? The fire is so hot that the men dragging them die. The soldiers of Nebuchadnezzar, they can't even get close to the furnace without being burned up. And so they are around there for a while, and so Nebuchadnezzar's waiting for them to be burned up, although it should have been instantaneous. There should have been a sign already, right? King Nebuchadnezzar was astonished and rose up in haste. He declared to his counselors, "Did we not cast three men bound into the fire?" They answered and said to the king, "True, O king." He answered and said, "But I see four men unbound. Walking in the midst of the fire, they are not hurt, and the appearance of the fourth is like a son of the gods." Of course, we know what's happening here, right? Some sort of angelic being has descended to give them protection in the fire. 26 and 27, Nebuchadnezzar came near to the door of the burning fiery furnace, and he declared, "Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego, servants of the Most High God." Oh, now he acknowledges God. "Come out. Come here." Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego came out from the fire, and the satraps, the prefects, the governors, the king's counselors gathered together and saw that the fire had not had any power over the bodies of those men. The hair of their heads was not singed, their cloaks were not harmed, and no smell of fire had come upon them. Not even the smell of the fire. And it is interesting when Nebuchadnezzar realizes that he's beaten, realizes that he has lost this little battle of wills, then he recognizes God. Then he declares, "Servants of the Most High God." And yet this was not the first time the king had acknowledged Jehovah, because literally what happened in the previous chapter, just like 20 verses before this, 30 verses before this, as Daniel had given the vision and interpreted the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had had, Daniel 2, 46 and 47, then King Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face, paid homage to Daniel, commanded that an offering and incense be made up to him. The king answered and said to Daniel, "Truly your God is God of gods and Lord of kings, a revealer of mysteries, for you have been able to reveal this mystery." It's not like Nebuchadnezzar didn't know who Jehovah was. It's not like he didn't know what he was capable of. He had already acknowledged that Daniel's God was superior. Why was he so surprised when Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego were unharmed? He goes back and forth and flip-flops, and one day he acknowledges God, the next he's all about himself. One day he praises Jehovah, the next he's praising himself. Back and forth and back and forth. Daniel 3:29, at the end of this whole fiasco with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, "Therefore I make a decree, any people, nation, language that speaks anything against the God of Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego shall be torn limb from limb. Their house is laid in ruins, for there is no other God who is able to rescue in this way." And yet, I said Daniel 3 and 4 are part of a two-act play, because in Daniel chapter 4, he's just going to go back again. Prideful, arrogant ways. Right now, because of the great thing that's happened, he's willing to acknowledge Jehovah, but it's not going to take very long for him to just go back to praising himself and elevating himself and saying how great he is. Daniel 4, 2 through 3, no, we're going to skip that. The king is the perfect example of many who worship God. Even today, I'm talking about. The king is the perfect example of many who worship God. Because to worship God and to please him are not the same thing. To worship God and to serve him are not the same thing. There are many people today who worship God one day and the next day just do their own thing. Who perhaps acknowledge God in times of success, or the opposite more often, pray to God in times of trouble, And yet when things are going well or when life gets in the way, they just go back to serving themselves. To worship God and to serve him are not the same thing. Nebuchadnezzar worships God quite a bit, actually. He acknowledges God's superiority. He praises Jehovah, God of the heavens. He even makes a decree, anyone who speaks against Jehovah will be torn limb from limb. And yet, does that change his behavior in any way? No. It does us no good to worship God if we will not submit to his will. It does us no good to worship him and acknowledge his greatness. It does us no good to one day say how awesome Jehovah is if we will not the next day submit to his instructions. There's a difference between submission and acknowledgement. Many people acknowledge God. Many people worship him. Many people praise him. Many people admit that he exists. But that is not the same as submitting to him. The Sanhedrin, those who would accuse, Jesus and Peter and John, they acknowledged God. They admitted that Jehovah existed. But they did not humble themselves before him. And one of the things that Jesus says over and over in the Gospels is, you have perverted the instruction of God. You have perverted the commandments of the Old Testament. You have given the appearance of righteousness, but you are not doing righteous things. So while the Sanhedrin acknowledged God, they did not humble themselves. And this led them to hate Jesus and oppose the apostles. Why are they opposing the apostles in Acts chapter 3 and 4? Because they did not submit themselves to God. The king acknowledged God, but did not humble himself. King Nebuchadnezzar wanted to have it both ways. God, thank you for giving me the kingdoms of the earth. Thank you for blessing me in such an awesome way. But that's as far as I want our relationship to go. You keep blessing me and you keep giving me awesome stuff and I'll just keep doing my own thing. But isn't that the way we act a lot of times today? Don't we do the exact same thing? God, I'd really like you to help me get my promotion. I'd really like you to help me in my relationships with my family. I'd really like you to bless me in my finances. I'd really like you to make it so that I'm not as persecuted. I'd really like you to help me in my life. But don't ask me to change anything. We want to have it both ways. And it just doesn't work that way. The passage that we started with in James chapter 3, God opposes the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore, be wretched, you sinners. Mourn and weep, and let your laughter be turned to mourning. Humble yourselves before God, and he will exalt you. It's not enough to just acknowledge who God is. We have to do what God said. Daniel's friends, along with Jesus and the apostles, demonstrated what it means to submit rather than simply acknowledge. Because Daniel's friends, that is, were willing to let their lives be bad because of their service to God. They were willing to let their lives be negatively affected by their service to Jehovah. That's what Peter and John were doing, right? They were willing to let their lives be negatively affected. That didn't matter. They were going to serve God anyway. Submission versus acknowledgement. The question we end with is this: are we willing to let our submission to God actually affect our lives, to change what we do and what we say, to change our priorities? Yes, even if it gets difficult, but most of the time it's not going to be difficult, right? The changes that God demands of us a lot of times are actually in our benefit. But that needs to be a secondary thought. Being willing to submit to God to the extent that our lives are actually different than before we did that. How different is your life now than before you knew God? And if the answer is it's not different at all, you might want to reconsider, have you really submitted to God's will? Are we willing to submit to God to the point of actually changing our lives?